Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to introduce our guest speaker who has come afar this morning. I'm Tim Burkett, the head teacher here, and this is Ben Connolly, who's a priest in training here. And Ben has been coming here for about 9 years. He's a musician and a music teacher, and he's been in training to be a priest for a year and a half, so I'm delighted to hear him speak this morning, and I hope you guys will be too.
Thanks, Tim.
Good morning.
It's lovely to be here with you today. Today I'm going to talk about loving and letting go. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the practices of cultivating loving kindness and mindfulness of death. Guess which one's more popular? Cultivating loving kindness is often called metta practice. Metta is an old Indian word from the Pali language, which means loving kindness. And both practices that I'll be talking about are from some of the earliest Buddhist teachings. And I'll be talking about these, and then at the end we'll actually just do metta practice, which is a meditation practice. Because I guess meditating together doesn't sound like a bad idea. So I've been studying Yogacara, which is a 5th century Indian school of Buddhism, recently, in preparation for a course I'll be teaching this summer. And Yogacara, one of the main emphases of Yogacara is habit energy, or our habits, or mental tendencies, karma, as the cause of suffering and as barriers to realization. So, the Yogacara school posits what they call the store consciousness, or the alaya consciousness, which is very similar to the idea of the unconscious in modern psychology. And basically they use this to look at the aspects of ourselves that usually we don't see, our tendencies that we're not really aware of, because the fact is most of us are motivated by things we don't really know what they are. We think we're just responding to an external thing right now and doing what we should be doing. But to a large part, our personalities and our characters are just governed by an agglomeration of previous conditioning, at least in this model of thinking. And so the idea is you can work with your store consciousness or with your unconscious, and you can transform habits which are harmful or cause suffering to you and others into ones which are helpful, which sounds pretty nice. So these practices I'm talking about are used for those purposes. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh actually has written a couple of quite good books on Yogacara, and he had one thing I really liked. I don't know if he made this up or if it's if he has some source. He doesn't often he doesn't give a source for if he's using some ancient teaching. But basically, he says there are three. He proposes three good ways to work with changing habit energy. So, one is cultivating positive mental dharmas, which could be, you could say, cultivating positive mental experiences. Dharma has a lot of meanings, but one of them is just an experiential moment. So cultivating positive mental dharmas, mindfulness of habit energy is the second one. So being aware of your habits as they come up, instead of just having them happening without you know they're going on at all. And finally, the third is intentionally drawing up and facing harmful habit energy. So this is, you know, really taking the things that are problematic and deciding to bring them into your consciousness. Guess which one's the most fun? So this first one Cultivating Positive Mental Dharmas. We're just talking about actually experiencing calm, experiencing love, experiencing beauty, experiencing joy, compassion. So this is stuff that we are encouraged to do. So, like, look at flowers. When you come here, just, you know, look at these flower arrangements that Pamela and Anne and Rebecca do, and just take in the beauty of the flowers. Or being around people who are very kind to you. I come here to Zen Center so that I can cultivate some positive mental dharmas. So I can just get some good, you know, loving, supporting people around me. I heard somewhere some Tibetan monk said, someone said, "What's your practice?" He said, "My practice is to be content." So this is a person who really put an emphasis on the practice of cultivating positive mental dharmas. And Zazen, our basic practice of meditation that we do here, is quite good for cultivating positive mental dharmas, because it is often, though certainly not always the case, that when you sit Zazen, you will experience some calm. You will experience some quiet joy. You will experience some sense of connection to where you are. So this is a wonderful way. And by doing Zazen, you cultivate the capacity to be present. So the second that he proposes, mindfulness of habit energy, he sort of emphasizes mindfulness of unwholesome or harmful habit energy. So this is maybe less fun, a little less fun, but the basic idea is, if you see when maybe you have a tendency to be gloomy when the sky is gray. Very simple. Common. Instead of just going around and complaining, or maybe posting on Facebook about how the weather sucks, not that anyone ever does that, you can just see the feeling that you're having, and really be present to your own emotional experience. You can have some awareness of the thoughts that you're generating about that emotional experience. So Zazen is very good for this, because we can have some space around the aspects of our consciousness that we usually don't see at all, particularly thinking. But also we can become more aware of what's happening in our bodies and our emotions and our thoughts, which are also closely related. So our basic practice here is quite good, I think, in terms of our basic Zazen practice. Quite good in terms of working towards this, changing our harmful habits to helpful ones. The third method he proposes is intentionally drawing up and facing harmful or difficult habit energy. And this is more difficult. This is something that Zazen does not do. It's not that, it's certainly the case that sometimes if you sit Zazen, you will suddenly, strong feelings will come up, and then you will have the opportunity to be present to them, and that can be quite transformative. But we don't sit down, it's like, come in here and be like, all right, now it's time to think about my terrible childhood. That's not the method. We don't have any such intention. So, but there are many Buddhist practices that really are about drawing up and facing things that we don't want to look at. The idea being that if you have the emotional strength to really look at the things that you don't want to look at, or the things that you try and push away, you have the strength, and you have the strength of practice and mindfulness that if you can bring your attention to them, there can be a transformation and a letting go. And why that happens is not so clear, but that it happens is quite clear. I think many people in this room can attest to it. So we do get to have some of this type of practice here at Zen Center, though. For example, you might really dislike washing windows, And if you come to a retreat someday, during work practice, someone will say, could you wash the windows? And if you have a good practice, you'll say yes. You'll say yes. And you'll go and you'll experience the washing of windows. You'll experience whatever aversion arises. And you may experience complete liberation from something you thought was a fundamental part of yourself. I don't like to wash windows. Why did I sew a raksu? I may be failing in memory. My principal reason for sewing a raksu was I hated sewing. Anytime I thought about sewing, it made me angry. It made me feel bad because I was like, I suck at sewing. I failed sewing class when I was in seventh grade. My brother and my mother are really good at working with their hands. Why do I? So I really, my biggest motivation for sewing my first raksu was to be present to whatever that was, because I thought, I don't want to hold on to this anymore. In fact, it was very difficult for me to sew a raksu. I had a lot of unpleasant emotional states. But the practice is to be mindful as you work. And as I was mindful with that, my aversion evaporated in the light of mindfulness. And a couple years later, I sewed an okesa, which is about 80 times bigger than this, and it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever done. Just sitting silently with people and working quietly at something. And that knot of ideas I had about who I was, and even if I didn't have those ideas, just that immediate emotional reaction of negativity toward this activity was gone. So, here at the Zen Center, we really emphasize Zazen, just sitting and being aware of what's arising. And we also use the old Soto Zen practice of taking basic elements of life and using them as the objects of our mindfulness. And those things, for the people who originally formulated this, were monastic things, so the ringing of bells, which maybe you don't do at home, I don't know. But, you know, the ringing of bells, bowing. But we take that and we extend it to cooking, and we extend it to working in the garden. These are our basic practice here. But I'm going to talk about these older practices, which we don't do here as much, but I think can be recommended. They were universally recommended according to the Pali Canon by the Buddha. There were not that many practices that he universally recommended of this type. Because they had a lot of different meditations that involved thinking about things. And metta, or cultivating loving kindness, and mindfulness of death were two that he said, this is going to be good for everyone. I actually am not going to entirely agree with him, which I will explain later, because I'm sure Buddha really needs my help. So let me just talk about metta practice for a minute. So metta is basically, when you practice metta, you assume a meditation posture, which we'll do in a little bit. And then you think of people, and then you go through some phrases to describe something about them. So first you think of yourself, and you say, may I be safe and protected. May I be happy and at peace. May I be healthy and strong. And may I be at ease. And the idea is you bring the light of your mindfulness to this experience to cultivate some positive mental dharmas. You know, you bring some loving thoughts into your heart. And then you think of someone you really love, and it's nice to take a minute to picture them and really kind of feel them in your heart. And you go through these phrases for them. May my son be safe and protected. May he be happy and at peace. May he be healthy and strong. May he be at ease. And you just experience what that does in your heart. And then you choose someone to whom you don't really have any feelings, but you can sort of imagine. So maybe someone that you see daily in the world of work or wherever. Just someone that you don't really have any strong feelings about, but you can go through these phrases for them. And you see what that feels like. And then you visualize someone who you really have a genuine feeling of ill will or dislike or anger towards. And you go through these phrases for them. And then you think of all four of those people standing before you together, and you think, all of you equally, I wish these things for you. And finally, we say these phrases for all beings. May all beings everywhere be safe and protected. May all beings be happy and at peace. May everyone be healthy and strong. May all beings through all time be at ease. I made up different words in the middle there. I actually don't think it's that important that you memorize these particular phrases. Sometimes I think it's actually even more effective not to memorize them, so that you're not going through a rote repetition, but you're actually calling into your heart some way of speaking about how you would love someone from inside. So, as you can imagine, perhaps, the part of thinking about wonderful things coming to someone towards whom you have ill will can be difficult. Maybe not. You don't know. But the practice is to look, to see with the light of mindfulness what's happening in your heart and in your mind and in your body. So metta is really a wonderful practice in that, in terms of these three methods that Thich Nhat Hanh proposes for transforming habit energy, it works really well with all of them. Clearly, if you think about loving thoughts for yourself and your loved ones, you see some positive mental dharmas. I mean, love, it's good stuff. It just brings something very helpful into your heart. But also, it has the aspect of drawing up and facing things you don't like, because you have to face the fact that when you're angry at someone, you suffer. When you say these phrases of appreciation and support for someone towards whom you have ill will, you feel the tension. You feel that tension, and you have to be with it. But by being with it, you can dissolve it. And the truth is, the ill will doesn't actually benefit you. Sometimes people will say, well, but if I'm angry, then I get motivated to do something. That's true. You can be motivated to do things. But I will use an example here. Every person here has been a child, and every one of them has experienced corrections from their parents. Now, at times, I suspect, when you did something that was harmful as a child, that was harmful to you or to someone around you, or would be developing harmful habits for yourself, on occasion, you received a correction from your parent, which was motivated purely by seeing that you were doing something that could be improved upon, that was devoid of any ill will or anger on their part, and they helped you to correct it. And every person here has been exposed to a parent that was extremely angry and frustrated and gave you a correction that they would have said, maybe, I'm just trying to help you. Obviously, you're doing something harmful. But their principal motivation was their own frustration and anger, or at least a big component of it that they couldn't see. And I think we can all intuit that that second form was not as helpful as the first. And probably, as parents, many of us are parents, we've all done the same thing. And this is just human nature. But we have the possibility and the capacity to do less motivation out of anger and more out of love. That's what this practice is about. So, I will move on to mindfulness of death, which people like to do metta and talk about metta. Mindfulness of death is emphasized quite a bit in the earliest Buddhist writings and becomes less emphasized, I'd say, over time. And once we get to America, we're not very into it. Zen masters, you know, many Zen masters talk about the great matter of life and death. So There are many ways of doing mindfulness of death, and actually for people who know a lot about Buddhism, the stuff in the Satipatthana Sutta, I would not teach that. It's not my thing. But I wanted to find something that I thought worked for a modern people, and I found one that I really like called the Five Remembrances. So I'll talk about these, the Five Remembrances. In general, I also will say that I don't universally recommend this practice. Buddha said, I universally recommend this practice, and he's probably right, but I'm not going to. Basically, I would say, when it comes to mindfulness of death, take your emotional temperature. If you're feeling fairly stable, or you're content, or you're happy, or you're doing well, this may be helpful to you. But if you are down or depressive, I don't think it's going to be helpful. I would really recommend working on cultivating some positive mental dharmas, being around some supportive people, doing metta, doing zazen, looking at flowers, something that holds you up. So this is something to think about. Mindfulness of death is a practice of facing up, drawing up and facing. So from that third set of practices I was originally talking about, it's not easily, it might end up being somehow a practice of cultivating positive mental dharmas, but that's probably advanced. It's more likely to just bring up some really difficult stuff, really fundamental stuff, attachment to the self and fear, very deep layers of attachment to self and fear. But as if you've had someone die, you know there's something when death comes into your life that it's very difficult, but it's also very beautiful. I'm going to tell a really silly story instead of a really touching one. Just lighten the mood here. So a couple days ago, someone I know, their job is to administer exams at a law school. And so they have to administer all the exams their department does. And one of the students, they found out, it was like, oh, I've got some challenges with my schedule right now. My father has been diagnosed with some terminal illness, and he's been hospitalized in extremely grave condition. And so they were taking care of things, and then a couple days later they said, well, you know, this person who administered the exam said, you know, we could allow you not to do the exam. We can give you an extension because obviously you have something to take care of. And this student said, well, given the way everything is going, I have enough time to be with my father right now, and if I take the exam now, it'll be more helpful because then I can really focus on being with him for the next quite a while. So I'd rather just take it. I think that's the best thing to do to take care of the situation. And so that's good. So the person went and took the exam. They were going to take the exam, and everyone's taking their exams, and there was a power outage. So the power all went out. And most people take exams on computers now, I guess. Apparently I'm old. remember Blue Books? So the power went out. And of course, everyone's kind of uptight. No, exam time. Wow, whoa. What's going to happen? And everyone starts freaking out. There are like people shouting at my friend across the room. It took her a long time, but they figured out what they were shouting was, my laptop runs on batteries. Revelation, I never thought of that. Really? So all you people are, oh, what's going to happen? The power's out. Their computers were on. The person whose father was dying was just working on their exam. They're like, all these people all over the place, freaking out. They're just working on the exam. And so then, the administrators are all like, what are we going to do? They're in the hall. They say, what are we going to do? This is a problem. Well, I said, okay, well, if the power comes out in a minute, we'll just give everyone an extension for a few minutes at the end. And if the power is out for a long time, we're screwed. And this person who's working on their exam, whose father is dying, just starts laughing. Because you know how screwed we are? We're really screwed. She's the only one who knew how screwed we are. And that was liberating. She didn't have to get caught up in like, oh, am I going to have 5 minutes off my exam? Am I going to miss a point? Am I going to get to work on time? Am I going to blah? Am I going to? Is my friend going to be nice enough to me? Is my wife going to make dinner? She was just there. Now I know what I have to take care of. This is what I have to take care of now. And then I know really what I have to take care of is the people I love. So this is a little story to show why mindfulness of death works. Because as anyone knows who's been close to death, it brings you close to what really matters to you. You realize how absorbed you normally are in things in your head that are not that important. I will say that it's true, sometimes when people are dying, people do really untoward things, they have fights, and that's real too. And, you know, that's a manifestation of habit energy. And so we can get ready to support people for dying by transforming our habit energy. So here are the five remembrances. And if you think this is cool, and like I say, you feel like you have a strong emotional base and a strong practice, you might consider just going and Googling this. And, you know, you could just every day say these at some point, maybe before or after you meditate. The five remembrances. I am sure to become old. I cannot avoid aging. I am sure to become ill. I cannot avoid illness. I am sure to die. I cannot avoid death. I must be separated and parted from all that is dear and beloved to me. I am the owner of my actions, heir of my actions. Actions are the womb. Actions are my relations. Actions are my protection. Whatever actions I do, good or bad, of these I shall become their heir. So we're not fixed people. We're not going to last forever. Nothing about us lasts forever. We're always changing. Change is an inevitable aspect of being. But what this holds out is that we have the potential to change for the better by focusing on what we're doing, taking care of what we're doing. Zen practice. Do what you're doing with your whole heart, your whole attention. What is that? Listening to me? Just do that. That's good enough. That's good enough. It's all here. So I would like to do metta practice with you all. So this is a meditation practice. So some people know you can just find a posture suitable for meditation, I guess a relaxed, upright position. And just take a moment to find some attention on your breath. You can close your eyes. So throughout the practice, you can let your attention rest. Whatever's arising in your emotions, thoughts, in the body. So just think of yourself. Bring yourself to the front of your consciousness. So you can say in your mind with me, or just listen, May I be safe and protected. May I be happy and at peace. May I be healthy and strong. May I be at ease. Whatever thoughts and feelings come, there's no need to judge them. Now think of someone you love a great deal, towards whom you have a minimum of ambivalence. You can picture them in your mind's eye. Think of their name. May my loved one be safe and protected. May they be happy and at peace. May they be healthy and strong. May they be at ease. Think of someone towards whom you don't really have any feelings, just someone you might have seen somewhere that you can picture their face. With this neutral feeling person, may you be safe and protected. May they be happy and at peace. May they be healthy and strong. May they be at ease. Think of someone, when you think of them, you usually feel angry or judgmental. Bring them into your mind's eye. their image, their name. Let's say, may this person be safe and protected. May they be happy and at peace. May they be healthy and strong. May they be at ease. Just stay with the feeling, whatever it is, where they are. Now call to mind yourself. The loved one you thought of before. The person towards whom you have no feelings. The person who brings anger or ill will into your heart. Set them all before you, equally standing. May you all be safe and protected. May you all equally be happy and at peace. May you all equally be healthy and strong. May you all equally be at ease. Now contemplate the vastness of the world. Billions of people, trillions of animals, plants, ground, the air, the water, other planets, all things in all directions. Through all time. May this all be safe and protected. May all be happy and at peace. May all things, for all time, all beings be healthy and strong. May all things be at ease. You may open your eyes. Just bring your attention back to this place. So, this was nice to do here together, and you can do it again on your own or with some friends. And I would like to invite comments or questions.
This is really timely for me. Thank you. It was timely because I've been experimenting with meta practice in a pretty diligent way for the first time for the past couple months. And strangely, I've hung the five remembrances by my meditation spot. Almost eerie. What I've noticed over the course of probably a month or so that I've been doing this, I haven't quite untied this, and I don't know necessarily that there's a knot to be untied, but on the surface it would seem that the five remembrances remind us that everybody gets sick and old and dies, and I'll be separated. And then I do this meta practice, which is I hope everybody is healthy and strong. You know, there's almost this kind of a contradiction. I hope everybody's at peace and happy and healthy, and yet everybody's going to get sick and die. Do you know what I mean? So there's like this almost like, well, I'm not sure if these two practices are perhaps canceling each other out or what that is. But you know, Zen is almost looking back to how things actually are, That the reason I decided to do this loving kindness for a period of time is it felt almost counterintuitive to me. Like, I'm wishing that, what it felt like is I'm wishing for something to be different than it is. I hope that you are really healthy and strong, and perhaps you're not. And so that, you know what I mean, almost felt like petitionary prayer. Oh, maybe. So I watched myself. There's like, who am I wishing to? Almost, you know, there's that sort of element to it. Anyway, so I don't know that there's necessarily an answer. I wondered if when you were doing this, if you found any kind of, if you had any feelings of like, there's almost a potential contradiction in wanting everything to be safe, happy, and healthy, and yet at the same time knowing it can't possibly be safe, happy, and healthy. I don't know if that. I'm just wondering if that arose.
Yeah. Well, I think Zen didn't invent impossible paradoxes. I think the Buddha set the tone way back. And I guess it's interesting. I view them. They do contradict each other in a way, but I would say they complement each other in the same way, because that petitionary aspect does something to your heart. It does something psychological. That's good, you know. So they do operate in these really opposite ways, and that's why I put them. That's probably why you put them together. Somehow they're good. What's up?
I just wanted to comment that curious thing. The thing that I like about the meta is that the thing looking at you think it's about connection. But I find out what happens in disconnection, which is really terrific. You disconnect yourself from the person you're angry with. You disconnect yourself from the person that you love. You disconnect your emotional relationship to other people. And the ending, so everything gets to be itself. Does that make sense?
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Because you disconnect your personal relationship. Who it is that you're. Whatever your relationship is
with. Right. So that does make sense. So basically you're saying the whatever preconditioning you have, you're just going, I'm just going to work with this love which I'm positing for everything and not get stuck in my pre-ideas or pre...
Well, if you're mad at somebody, you're keeping them away.
Right, yeah.
But by keeping them away, you're keeping yourself tight.
Right, yeah. Right.
By doing this, you're just saying, letting it be. Really, ultimately, all those questions just say, just let the person be, or you let everything be.
Mm. That sounds like a good idea. Except for let's let it be by attending to it completely and doing something active to benefit it. That's the way to let it be.
To go along with that, I like how at the beginning you're calling up people, like you said, based on your relationship to them, and you give them labels, and you see them as, this is the person I love, this is the person I hate, this is someone I don't care about. And then at the end, though, you line them all up, and it's like, we're equal. Like, the labels don't matter anymore, and it's just about, like you think, letting them be. I also got that from someone.
Well, so the funny thing is then where they'll talk about, you know, interpenetration, interconnectedness and everything, and then the other side of that is, you know, the famous sentence of you can't share a part with them. So there's both these two coexisting things of being interconnected and not being separate.
Mm. Yeah.
Just that.
Oh. I was thinking that we were doing this too about you know, bias, having bias toward happiness and safety and all those things, whereas if someone is unsafe or unprotected or is unhappy, can we also have a loving feeling when that's going on? See that and generate loving, well, exactly what the situation is. If it's unsafe, unprotected, unhappy, un all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sort of having a wholeness thing about it, like the dark side, some practices and other types of psychology, have us look at, the shadow and the dark side and the things that we want to deny or push away. I was thinking about, Charles Schultz and the Peanut character recently, and how I feel more akin to some of them, and others of them I don't feel so comfortable with, and maybe it's just that represents my shadow or my dark side that I don't feel comfortable with that, but there's part of me that is that character also,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, and in everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And just think about bias. We all have a picture of what health means. Mm-hmm. Could someone in a wheelchair be healthy?
Mm-hmm.
With an illness, a terminal illness or something, be as healthy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we can still apply that to that situation.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot can come up in some meta practice, I think. It's very interesting. But I think we should have tea. I think that's important. I love you guys, so I would like to give you the opportunity to eat a cookie. May all beings eat cookies.
And the cookies too.